Welcome to The Sound of Economics, the podcast series by Bruegel, the Brussels-based economic think tank. I'm Giuseppe Porcaro, and today we will talk about China's influence in Africa with a specific focus on the media narratives and the digital space. This episode is part of Bruegel's focus on global China, as seen from Europe, which includes our monthly newsletter, Zhongguan Mundus, link to subscribe in the show notes. And this feature is also part of Bruegel project China Horizon, funded by the EU under the Horizon program. I'm happy to have, as usual, with me, Alicia Garcia Herrero, and I would like to welcome her from Taipei. Hi, Alicia, how are you?
All fine, thank you, Giuseppe.
And I'm also happy to welcome Eugenio Gagliardone, who is Associate Professor in Media and Communication at the University of Witwatersrand in South Africa. His research focuses exactly on the topic of our podcast today, which is media studies, politics of technology, as well as China-Africa relations. Hi, Eugenio. Thank you for joining The Sound of Economics today.
Thank you for inviting me, Giuseppe. I'm glad to be connected on this platform.
Eugenio, are you connected from which city in South Africa?
Johannesburg. We're having protests at the moment, so I'm back in a kind of lockdown version, but it's not as bad as past lockdowns, but everything seems to be proceeding safely.
Good. Well, not good, but good for you to be safe. Let me start with a little bit of background, historical background on relations between China and Africa in general. Africa has been crucial to China's foreign policy since the end of the Chinese Civil War in 1947. China supported several African liberation movements during the Cold War, and for every year since 1950, Baiwan, the foreign minister of the People's Republic of China, has first visited an African country. And in 1999, fast-forwarding after the period of the liberation movements and after the opening up of the Chinese economy, China created already back then in 1999 its going out strategy, which encouraged Chinese company to invest beyond China, particularly in Africa. The strategy was a statement of China's growing economic might and created a new wave of Chinese engagement in Africa. It was also an important source of employment for Chinese citizens working on new infrastructure projects. In November 2003, the first triannual forum for China-Africa cooperation summit was held in Beijing. It was created to improve cooperation between China and African states and signaled China's growing strategic initiative in Africa, which 10 years later, in 2013, with the announcement of the China's Belt and Road Initiative, took a new level of engagement, as our Sound of Economics series in a different episode highlighting exactly the genesis and what is going on with the China Belt and Road Initiative. 10 years after the launch of the Belt and Road Initiative, we would like to frame Alicia a little bit before going into the media narratives and the digital issues a little bit. Where do we stand with China's relation with the African continent today?
Thanks very much, Giuseppe. And I'm really looking forward to this conversation with Eugenio. I know that we're going to really get into one of the key aspects, actually, of China's interest in the region. I mean, I've been looking at China's trade with Africa, China's investment in Africa. But in a way that follows a natural process, I may say. You know, Africa is of course a resource-rich continent, and China has always been interested because it's not as resource-rich whatsoever, and that has created complementarities between the two regions, and to be frank, except in at times of very high commodity prices, very unbalanced trade between China and Africa. At the same time, China has invested in Africa. I wrote a piece for Bruegel, and I think this remains true, that European remains the largest foreign direct investor in Africa. And although it doesn't seem, you know, if you read the news, it seems only China is there, but actually that this is not the case. It is more the case for trade than it is for investment. China, however, is massive in actual lending. And this brings us to, you know, the difficulties that the continent, or at least quite a few countries in the continent have in terms of repaying a much bloated debt, which has, for some, the result of this debt trap. But I would put it slightly differently because, you know, to be trapped, you need to be trapped in a way. You need to want to be trapped. So, you know, whether trapped is the right word, perhaps it's a question of discussion. But beyond the trap, I think we need to recognize that China's large inflow of loans, and this comes from China's own excess savings, has created, you know, the possibility or the funding possibility for Africa to embark in projects that might not have been possible otherwise. Yeah, and whether these projects actually now can be repaid, what is the real rate of return is a big question. So that's where we are. It's a very unbalanced relation. This is what I want to say. It's really a relation where the minute commodities prices go down, you have a large trade deficit. And on top of that, you need to pay a lot of a big debt service for massive debt as of now, especially after COVID. But what I want to say, and this brings me to the core of our conversation today, is that the narrative is the most interesting part of it. Because, you know, with what I said, you would imagine that Africa is probably one of the regions in the world where the image of China is worse because, you know, unbalanced trade, lots of debt, you know, interest payments. No, actually, China's image in and this is part of our research for China Horizons, as you know, Giuseppe, China's image in Africa is the second best after Central Asia. It has worsened, I have to say, but not as fast as other regions in the world. And I think that's in itself quite surprising. And it brings us directly to the topic of conversation today, which is media and digital, China's digital influence in the region, et cetera, et cetera. So I leave it there.
Thank you, Alicia. And I just want to remind our listeners that there is another episode of our Zongwa Mundus series exactly dedicated to the research that Alicia and a few other colleagues have been conducting and where they've been mapping exactly what Alicia was just saying about the perception specifically of the Belt and Road Initiative, but in general, the sentiment of China, globally speaking. Where this result about Africa was particularly evident. And I would say this introduces and gives me the opportunity to ask the question to Eugenio, since Eugenio, you've been studying and mapping out the influence of Africa within the media landscape, but also the telecommunications and digital landscape. To help us understand a little bit more this mirroring story about narrative building and somehow complementary action to what Alicia just told us about the economic presence and the diplomatic strategy extremely linked to this economic presence in the past few decades. So, Eugenio, the ball is yours.
So I will start with two examples. One, it was of a successful narrative built by China, and one was a very unsuccessful narrative, but it received a lot of attention abroad. So the first one is, we just mentioned, you know, the Belt and Road Initiative. It started in 2013, you introduced it. And it seems that the word woke up to China investing in the digital space then. It was just, you know, giving a new name to activities that has been going on for at least a decade. And China started investing massively in the digital space, especially in the infrastructure space in Africa, at mid-2000, 2003, 2005. That's when the large project starts appearing. And but since very few people took notice, actually some of the largest loan in that space have occurred before the digital, some people say there is a digital component of the Belt and Road Initiative. And China was very successful in using just this simple combination of words as reminiscent of the historical Silk Road to grab headlines in Europe, in the US, in Africa. But actually, if you look at the actual data, a great place to go is the CARI initiative of Johns Hopkins that just closed recently, but the data is still available there, is the China-Africa Research Initiative. The vast majority of support in this space happened in the first decade, and then it has been going down, which doesn't mean that China has lost interest, because companies have become more prominent. So it's not as much diplomatic relations that coalesce into a contract. Huawei and ZTE, when it comes to like urban surveillance and support, have become stronger, but not in a way that not as clearly builds into direct loans coming from the Chinese government. And moving to the unsuccessful narrative that received a lot of attention, 2012, China opens, at the time it was CCTV, opens the largest TV and news in general, newsroom on the continent in Kenya. And the CNN reported about it, the Al Jazeera reported on their own competitors. And the idea was China, the Chinese television, now it's CGTN, are the one who are investing more than anybody else into this space because they want to change the narratives. Well, they haven't changed anything, if at all. And even idea, I was lucky enough in 2012, was doing research in Kenya. It was not on CCTV, CGTN, but I was welcome to spend time in the newsroom with the Chinese reporters and their African colleagues. And the idea was to tell the good stories about Africa. But research coming from colleagues, media researchers across the world, have shown that actually, CGTN doesn't report less on conflict than the BBC or the CNN does. What it does, it might want to depict the contradiction of the United States, especially when it comes to exporting democracy or helping other countries. And this goes back to old Cold War style propaganda connecting China and the USSR. But in terms of like changing the minds of African citizens, connecting, you know, what matters is not CGTN, it's Netflix, it's Disney Plus, these are the juggernauts that grab people's attention. And if you don't have the means, of course, and you have satellite TV or other digital television, you have in your carnet the Chinese channel. But I barely know anyone. I've been living in South Africa for 8 years now, who regularly connect to those channels to get the news. And, you know, the news comes from social media, the entertainment comes from like large provider and platform like Netflix, and they just came too late. Maybe 10 years earlier, when Al Jazeera was still at the beginning, they could have been a competitor, but no, they didn't change the narrative at all.
You basically are saying that Al Jazeera, for example, just to make an example of big media outlets outside the Western world at large, as to say, is much more of a grip than the Chinese media.
Well, Al Jazeera is still, Al Jazeera earns its reputation in a very challenging time, you know, the Iraq wars and so forth. It was difficult to have a different views on global politics. And Al Jazeera has kept that kind of image. Again, large international broadcasters are suffering everywhere. So I think you have to go to a lobby of a hotel to see Al Jazeera, you know, streaming into people's mind. I don't think a lot of people at home tuning in on Al Jazeera these days, unless there is a major emergency.
And maybe zooming out from this big, gigantic network, but more like into the granular investment and presence of China within the media landscape. Is China trying to influence in other ways as well the narratives? How do you see that that operation to happen on the ground? Because we've been somehow with Alicia on their research, we've been seeing this operating at the macro level. It will be interesting to see how it actually then take shape, if not with the CCTV, but then with other means.
Well, for a long time, there was a curiosity or about what Chinese platform would take root in Africa. You know, we were used to Facebook, we were used to Twitter, we were used to Snapchat at some point, Instagram. And there is a very strong tie between a South African company, Naspers, and Tencent. Naspers was incredibly lucky to invest in Tencent when nobody knew about Tencent. And they were like going around the world to look for capitals. And that's in a few years, the whole capitalization of Naspers is basically based on Tencent because of the success that they made. So is WeChat going to take root in Africa? They tried in many different ways and it never worked, despite WeChat is an amazing app, but it's not as exportable as others. And then TikTok came. And it took, you know, the world by storm. Nobody was saw it coming. And I think this is the only example of a kind of a smaller kind of venture that doesn't have a large corporation. Well, TikTok is quite large now, but, you know, compared to Huawei or ZTE, it's still pretty small. And making waves onto the continent. I would expect if you go around the street of Johannesburg or Nairobi or Kinshasa or like any other African capital and ask who owns TikTok, a lot of people would have no idea. They would have no idea that it's Chinese or not. At smaller level, again, it's difficult to decouple smaller intervention with larger players. And when it comes to digital surveillance, there can be a relatively small project in complex metropolis, and these are still developed by Huawei and ZTE that have a big footprint. There was a case of a Chinese AI company that specialized in facial recognition, was CloudWalk, and he signed a contract with the governor of Zimbabwe. And this is another example of some of the moral panics that comes with China. So the signing of the contract per se was seen as, and there were some headlines, of the digital panopticon is coming to Africa, because the idea was to sample, to build a database of all Zimbabwean citizens. And the same piece of news continues to be reported almost to our days. And the project folded. It didn't turn into anything because of corruption, because of some other issues, change. You know, there was a coup d'etat, a soft coup d'etat in Zimbabwe, but still was a coup d'etat. And so China is scary, and there are good reason to think that China is scary, because I think the kind of like surveillance state and inability to promote narratives that are within the Chinese border that are in contradiction with the official narratives is simply absurd. But we need more people on the ground. We need more researchers that actually can tell what is actually happening and not just based on like the assumption of what might happen, of the fears that China is going to take over the world and impose its model, which is not happening right now. It doesn't mean that it's not going to happen in the next one or two decades.
Alicia, would you like to add a first reaction to what extremely interesting insight we just heard from Eugenio?
Well, I think, first of all, it is a great example of what we in Europe miss all the time, which is this variety of interests and an understanding of the world. I mean, it's not only about China. It's the fact that it doesn't have to be necessarily only what the US produces in terms of digital experience, and China happens to be there. And I think that's the positive is the diversity, the depth of the global south, if we can use that expression, which we have missed for so long in the West. But of course, the question is, why China? Why not India? Why not Brazil? Why not, you know, why exactly China? One could argue, well, because China has, you know, as many Fortune 500 as the US, and it's a massive country. But I think it's more complex than that. And that, I think, is very interesting. It's also the role of media, the role of surveillance, the role of shaping narratives. And I think, I wonder, what's the degree of awareness? You just said that people don't know TikTok is a Chinese company. To be frank, even in Europe for a long time, this was the case. So, you know, how what's what's the degree of awareness, and what does it mean for you? I think that would be my question after hearing these very interesting comments.
Well, let me just pick up on awareness. I think there has been a lot of pointing fingers at China. And some of these pointing fingers is correct. There have been like cases of excessive use of surveillance or a contract that were signed with the governments that are very far from being democratic. So I'm not trying to defend China's position. But if our concern is a concern about citizen right to be aware of what is going on, how are their presence, how are their ability to control what happens with their data in the information society, that's our starting point. China is just one of the very many players, and we should hold all of these actors accountable. And there was a case very recently, and I'm sure it made the headlines, parts of it. It was the Francis Hauger revelation when it came to Facebook. Maybe a piece that was less publicized in Europe was how much Facebook executives were very aware that Facebook was being used in conflict to incite hatred between two different camps, belligerent groups that were killing each other. And there was no willingness from the side of Facebook to invest in better content moderation in that particular space, because Ethiopia, in this case, is not one of the primary market. And so it's very difficult. And of course, the association between Facebook and the US is very clear. Some people might not know that TikTok is Chinese, but almost everybody knows that Facebook is American. So when it comes to advancing an idea of a more open, more citizen-centered, more user-centered information society, in Africa, there is awareness that those companies that used to have the high ground could just push their ideas of we are here for connectivity, we won't be evil. They have lost that kind of reputation. They've lost it on the ground. And so people say, well, you are, you know, attacking China, but a lot of these companies have not a better reputation in the continent over the years. And the leaks have been just one of the examples. So we have to take a position that is less based on geopolitics and is based, if we can, more on human politics and the reality of people using these technologies to achieve which kind of visions. And I don't think that the what is on people's minds every day is, like, should we decide from China or the US, which is the model? This could be a question that people were asking themselves in the, you know, late 1990s, early 2000s. But right now, the issues are very, very different. And we should be aware of this if we want to push a different kind of information, or we don't want to just point fingers, but we want to advance an idea of a more inclusive space. And I think Europe has a big role to play in that regard, because Europe has shown with the Digital Service Act, for example, how a united front can stand up to large company, to big tech, and enforce a user-centered idea of the information society. So Europe, we haven't talked about Europe so far, and I know that Europe is very much on your minds, but even if Europe hasn't produced one of these large platform that becomes successful, where Spotify, to some regard, could be considered that, but, you know, not a social media as such, but it has a role to play. And the connection, both in terms of trade and finance, as you just said, and the continent and many others, is really strong.
I'll get back to Europe after, because, of course, we want to have a bit of a discussion about the role and what can be done by the European Union and Europeans. But you... building up on what you said about the Western companies, I mean, somehow it makes me think about the way, and this is something that also, Alicia, you've been discussing in your research, the way China has been somehow exploiting the weaknesses of Western approaches to Africa, and somehow riding the wave of the Africa Rising narrative, if we want to call it like that, in order to ensure that penetration within the continent could be achieved, also somehow overshadowing the bad sides, or like the problematic sides, and trying to to build the narrative on the positive, or where there could have been an alignment within Africa and China against the West, for example, and certainly things like the ones you mentioned about the role of Facebook and other platforms, global platforms, have been playing in the continent. They definitely have been functional, at least to say the least, to this kind of use. How do you see this thing? I mean, like, how China is contributing to a certain extent, it seems that it's contributing on one hand to this narrative about Africa rising and so on, but on the other, there is also a trap, this debt trap, this trap between service delivery and somehow conditions which are not spelled out in some of the relations that are being built. How do you see, I don't know if Alicia or Eugenio wants to build up on that, but definitely there is a tension over there between the narrative and what is going on the political and economic level at the same time.
Well, just very briefly, of course there is. And I think we are increasingly living in a world of narratives because we don't really know what is real anymore. And I think that's not only China. I mean, as you rightly pointed out, this is we need to recognize that the West and certainly the US play a big role in shaping narratives. And I think that the recognition that this is beyond, you know, you can call it a trade war, a tech war, a cold war, but it's clearly a narrative war that we know. I think the interesting part I found from Inyo's presentation is that we should not be naive enough to think that Africa has only China's narrative or the US narrative, that there's also other narratives, yeah, that these vibrant continents, and I think the same can be said about India, have their own dynamics. And I think this is very important for us because we don't need to place ourselves in this, you know, competition, strategic competition between the US and China, because not even Africa does. I mean, we should learn, you know, that there is space to keep our narratives and to develop them. And you know, with the diversity that we have in Europe, it's actually a wonderful thing to think of. So in a way, learning, I'm thinking, you know, from listening to Eugenio, how much we can learn actually from this vibrant continent for Europe. And I think that's one of the key takeaways from me from this podcast.
Eugenio, what is your reaction to what I'm saying about this tension? Like, how much, this is more like from a Chinese perspective, I would say, but then the other question by Alicia about what is then the African narrative, like where is Africa with its own agency placing themselves within this?
Unfortunately, African agency is one of the things that gets forgotten because also it's easier to report about, you know, a tension between these two, you know, the two largest superpower. We're back again. To an era that we was very much in the past, but in a way, I see it from a point of view of a university, you know, the University of East Rajasthan in South Africa. Africa is rising. The level of thinking, of creative way, especially in the humanities, maybe less so when it comes to engineering, artificial intelligence. There is still Africa is lagging, but when it comes to the humanities, where I am, the new ways to imagine relationship between human beings, gender relationships, relationship between race, the narrative, but also the scholarly production, it's massive, and it's taking, you know, all issues related to transformations that are very much discussed in the US, also in Europe. Here in South Africa and in a few other places are very mature. So agency in terms of like thinking in ways that are original. And when it engages with Europe, of course, there is a very clear memory of the colonial past, but not in ways that is resentful, in a way that is creative, in the way that it just wants to put the awareness about how this period of domination is still leaving traces. And I read, I'm going to use two articles, not written by me, but by other colleagues, and that for me was offering an example of very original ways to look, in this case, at China and Africa. One was by a colleague in Cape Town, originally from Kenya. Her name is Kimari, and and was looking at the train built by China in Kenya. And he was connecting this train with the train that was built by the British. And what she was arguing with her colleague was the same way of racial displacement that was created by the railway built by the British has very strong similarities with what is built by China. At the time, was creating areas where only certain people could or could not go. And now it's different. But the displacement of who has agency, who can drive the train. For a long time, also only a Chinese appointed conductor can drive the train, or the way in which the connection is created with the state, but not with the citizen. And so what they were arguing is that China is saying that is displacing older players with a new narrative that is more attentive to the needs of the South. What she's saying is China is replacing this with the same logic. That doesn't seem, from the very beginning, I never said China is neocolonial. China never colonized anyone in Africa. So I'm not saying it's a colonial power, it's recolonizing, but the logics, it's not as a big player becoming colonial, but the logic are by default, because of this police player, re-racializing relationship between human beings in this space. And there is a very strong pushback. And I think, and this is coming from African scholars, say, we don't buy the debt trap. We don't say that China is better or China is worse. But let's look at how the infrastructure affects communities and see whether or not it's different or similar to what happened in colonial times. For me, it's very powerful. And the second one is more technical. This, again, has nothing to do with the digital, but I think it was a very interesting example. A researcher died by a Chinese scholar in the US. I can give you the details for the show notes. And looking at wind farms. And wind farms built by China in Ethiopia and wind farms built by France. In both cases, usually in these kind of cooperation, there's a third party that does technology transfer. It's a McKinsey or the like. So like someone who's just strong consultancy answer. And the Ethiopian governments at the time say, no, you're not going to hire a consultant, not to the Chinese, not to the French. There are strong universities in this region where you are installing the wind farms. You're going to hire the local academics and their PhD students. They are going to do technology transfer, not you guys, and or not the company from Europe or from the US that you are hiring or from China. And that was extremely powerful. That shows African agency. We want to be able to operate. We can't build them. We don't have the skills to build them. And we want to train our own academics, our own engineers to be able to operate, understand, and maybe create a foundation for building the next wind farm. And that narrative about Africa, it's completely missed in most of the reporting.
One last question, because we are going towards the end of this episode. Obviously about Europe, because we've been mentioning before, it is a player we clearly are interested in, especially us here at Bruegel, but more in general, like, where do we position the EU in all this? I would say, what could be, we've been seeing the multiplication of the changes into the names of different initiatives. So we've been seeing a global connectivity initiative, then the global gateway, and so forth. There is an overall rethinking at the EU level about cooperation with the African continent, which is switching from the old just purely development cooperation strategy to something that is much more embedded into this web of global relations, and of course intertwined with our conversations we are having about the China action and presence over the continent, but not only, definitely within the world global landscape. It will be interesting, of course, with Alicia, we come back to this many times, because trying to always analyze and see and also be self-critical about the strengths and the weaknesses at the same time of our external actions as European Union. But on the other hand, also some kind of different perspective, Eugenio, you can bring us from where you are standing in South Africa about how the EU is perceived over there. So I think that would be an interesting way of concluding this episode. Gino, maybe you can go first, and then I will leave Alicia for commenting and giving some last input.
Well, I think Europe has an enormous role to play. And when it comes to the digital space, increasingly so, because Europe, even if it hasn't produced a Facebook or a Google or, if you move to China, TikTok, has gained legitimacy because of the diversity that it can accommodate and the strength that is shown for decades against the largest players, the big tech. We saw it from like decoupling Microsoft was Explorer at the time with the operating system. And then we saw it again with the Digital Service Act and so forth. So in a way, Europe has shown to have been consistent towards thinking about the users and the consumer and being able, because of its strength, to go after this large player. They are becoming almost monopolist into this space. And also the legislative process, when it takes a long time to come up with a resolution or with something like the Digital Service Act, or the GDPR when it comes to privacy, but then all that work pays off in terms of like being used as a model or being adapted to local legislation. And, I don't have to mention to you like the Brussels effect and Anu Bradford and how she wrote about it and the reason why this is happening. I also saw something that I want to share. You guys know Brussels, Giuseppe, live in Brussels. You know Brussels, how it works more than I do. But I was there less than a year ago for a conference convened by Carnegie. And we had the chance to meet some representative of the European Commission and the Parliament, and very eloquent, very good ideas. But after Anu Bradford, after the idea of the Brussels Respect became famous, I think Europe has become a bit complacent. Some of them were saying, oh, the Digital Service Act is there. Now we're just waiting for the world to copy it. It can be a risk. That was a strength. But if Europe becomes arrogant, saying, well, we are producing laws for everybody else in the globe to adapt, it might lose its advantage and its edge. So I think on the one end, these processes, we see it also with the Artificial Intelligence Act that is being discussed, there is a lot of very good ingredients for Europe to really lead in terms, also because it does it with the interest of the users and the citizen and the consumers at heart. And this has become quite apparent. But it also has to be humble. Because then accusation of, oh, here it comes like the old colonial powers, they're going to come and tell us how we should do things because they do it better. That's not going to fly. That's not going to fly in Africa in 2023. So I think that's my only word of caution. I think there is this very precious capital that is in the end of different actors operating in the European Union, but they should be very careful with how this is presented and the collaboration that are being developed with different actors, because that advantage can be lost very quickly.
Alicia?
Well, I think it's a very interesting point because, and I will be very brief. I mean, there's two things here. On the one hand, Europe is underwhelming or perceived underwhelmingly because we are a big investor, but nobody notices. On the other hand, though, on regulation, we're perceived as basically the elephant in the room, and we're not noticing that could be counterproductive. So basically, I guess what Europe should be doing as regards Africa is to come more as an investor and less as a regulator, because, just to balance its image and possibly its impact in the region. And that, I think, is a takeaway from this conversation.
Thank you, Alicia. And on these notes, even though we could discuss much longer, this is all the time we have for this episode, which was part of Bruegel's Focus on Global China as seen from Europe, which includes as well our monthly newsletter, Zhongguo Mundus, which we invite you to subscribe. The link is in the show notes. This feature was also part of Bruegel Project China Horizon, funded by the EU under the Horizon program. As usual, you can read in open access all the analysis by our scholars on our website, www.bruegel.org. Eugenio, Alicia, thanks a lot for joining this conversation, and thanks to all our listeners for tuning in to The Sound of Economics. Until next time, bye-bye.